Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Trump and the anonymous op-ed. So, Richard, since our last show, we saw this op-ed published in the New York Times anonymously, which is unusual, from someone that the Times identified as a, quote, senior official in the Trump administration. That's all we know at this point. And in the course of this piece, the staffer says that there are people in the administration who, this is a quote as well, are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of the president's agenda and his worst instincts, close quote. Now, just to make the context of this clear, this person says that they're not a leftist. They think the administration is actually doing a lot of good things, but that the president himself and his management, or lack thereof, and his personality is the problem. And we're not told exactly how they're frustrating his agenda, but this also coincides with a new Bob Woodward book in which there are stories about things like staffers taking documents off the president's desk, trying to hide things from him. So let's start here with the angle of the piece being anonymous amongst the people who are touting this, Richard, as a sort of a great civic contribution by whoever this anonymous staffer is. They will point to historical analogies. You've seen this in print a couple times this last week. Well, the Federalist Papers were written anonymously. How well do those kinds of analogies hold over in a case like this?
Well, let's start with the analogy. I think it's a terrible analogy. It's not at all clear why it is that the Federalists decided to put these things anonymously. But what they did, in effect, was to make a series of arguments about the desirability of the Constitution. They had multiple authors, chiefly Madison and Hamilton, not two people, I think, who have anything to hide at the particular time. What they were doing was making abstract disquisitions, and the theory might have been these arguments will go better if you don't have to attach them with any particular person. There are other cases in which people want anonymity. For example, if they have made campaign contributions to somebody, they may well fear retaliation if their names are broadcast, and I think it's perfectly okay to do that. But this is a very different kind of situation. Put aside the fact that everything that was said here was already known to everybody before it was said in some sense. When you publish something anonymously, which is defamatory of another individual, or arguably so, and then you hide away from it, what happens is you're doing so in a way which will necessarily cause all sorts of friction, demoralization, and resentments inside the administration, which will make it harder for the president to govern and for all the people inside the administration to work. What this is in effect, like sort of casting a cloud of suspicion over each and every person inside the administration. All of them have to wonder whether or not the leak happened to come from somebody else. Everybody's going to speculate if the president finds out exactly what's going on, what's going to happen. Somebody's going to ask if this thing was in fact anonymous as it was and was insidious and false. Is it going to be defamation? Is there some kind of a criminal action taking place? Because most of the people who work in the White House have to take some kind of agreement on confidentiality, which this clearly is breached. And so it seems to me that this is a very, very different thing. And it's also clear that the New York Times recognized that, because in its preface, what it said quite simply is, this is relatively unprecedented. We would only do this in extreme times and not for ordinary people. And the clear implication of that is these are extreme times. And so it's yet another editorial statement by the New York Times that it regards the Trump administration as utterly unfit to serve. So I don't think they should have done it. I think the correct course of action under circumstances of this sort is for the individual either to remain silent and to continue to try to walk the president back off the ledge, which is basically what he said he was doing, or to say, look, I think there are many fine people in the administration, but I'm going to resign from this administration and publish it under my own name so that at least I can remove all the confusion and animosities that might exist when everybody's trying to figure out who is responsible for what. And so I think, in effect, that this reflects ill on the character of the person who did it. I also think it reflects ill on the character of the New York Times, but that's no surprise, at least coming from me. And I think in some sense the incident is relatively unfortunate, mainly because of the way in which it was undertaken. I don't think it's particularly unfortunate because of what was said in this particular case. Everything that was said in this case has been said 1,000 times by 1,000 people on each and every one of these points. The president is not to be trusted. He has on these tears. You have to keep him away from documents. You try to shut down his tweeting ability. You're trying to run a normal administration. At the same time, you have a president who thinks that the White House is no different from the corner office that he had when he was running his own Trump business. And I think, you know, these are all valid charges to be made. I don't think they should be made in this fashion.
Now, Richard, the president has subsequently called on the Justice Department to investigate and potentially prosecute the author of this piece. And the media has largely portrayed that as vindictive and kind of unhinged. Is that your view?
Well, let me put it this way. The most effective strategy for dealing with Donald Trump is to wave a red flag in front of him so he'll take some kind of precipitate action. And I think one of the reasons why they published this thing anonymously is they wanted to see that kind of blowback from him. But the question about whether or not you investigate this criminally, there's at least the following sense to it. If you could look at the set of statutes, which I have not done, and what they say is that you must keep confidential all the material that take place with the president, and you cannot engage in acts of public disparagement. And this is a willful and conscious breach of a very serious duty owed to the president, which compromises the operation of the administration. It certainly doesn't help it. One could at least ask the question, maybe there's not a criminal situation, but dismissal and perhaps some kind of fine is warranted, perhaps some other kind of censure is warranted. I don't think that it's completely extreme. The question you always have to ask about this, is it worth it? The president is sure to get these kinds of criticism that he overreacts, and what's going to happen is then people are going to say that he's overreacting, he's going to say something equally violent in the other way, and we have another Trump tear, which will continue to go until he manages to do something which is regarded as profoundly foolish on some other issue, at which point this will just be part of the background noise of the administration rather than the stuff on the front burner. But if this were an ordinary president and this kind of leak had taken place and somebody had said something like this, I think everybody would have had exactly a very different reaction. So just imagine that there was a closet conservative in the late Obama administration who said the problem about the president is that he's always intriguing with his friends in order to do in his enemies. And they published that anonymously and so forth. I think there would be a pretty strong reaction, and I don't think the press would say that Obama, measured as he always is, would be acting beyond his particular capabilities and entitlements if he tried to find out who that leaker was. If you want to take yet another example, there are lots of cases involving corporate officials, and there's no question if the head of a major corporation had been defamed in this particular fashion by some anonymous underling, there's no question that the law firm that they would hire, the president, the CEO, would hire a law firm, they'd run an internal investigation, and they might be willing to press criminal charges. So I think that's a little bit hyperbolic, but I think the reason that it's done is if you could get another rise out of Trump, you'll prevent the Republicans from ever gaining the kind of equilibrium that they need in order to prevail in either the House or the Senate or both come the midterm elections.
The other big revelation in here is that the author says, I'm going to quote again, "There were early whispers within the cabinet of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would start a complex process for removing the president," close quote. Now, the 25th Amendment is new as constitutional amendments go. We've only had it since 1967. And the part of it that the author is referring to is Section 4, which is the only section that's never been invoked, under which the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can declare that the president is unable to do the job, and that triggers an at least temporary suspension of his powers. But is this as clean a solution as the author of the piece makes it sound like, Richard?
No. I think, in effect, what you'd have to do is to get the vice president to turn on the president. He's been perhaps too much of a loyalist. That's what Pence has been. But I can't conceive of how it is that you're going to get the entire cabinet turn on the president on the strength of something which everybody would regard as illegitimate in terms of the way in which it was released. I think in order to trigger the 25th Amendment, you're going to have some public act which is so unambiguously bizarre that it forces everybody who is in the high position to make a judgment on this, to say something about it. And to simply have yet another whispering campaign against the president strikes me as a wrong way to do this. I kind of analogize this in my own mind to the way in which they managed to flip Michael Cohen to get him to say, in order to get, I think, an easier plea, although nobody knows this for sure, I was told explicitly by the president that he had to buy off Stormy Daniels so that it would avoid difficulties in the election. I don't think, in effect, that you could make a case like this out of allegations that appear anonymously. I think what you have to do even before the process should go is to have some indisputable public acts which reflect that kind of instability, and then you can see whether or not to have it. It's an extremely grave step to take, and if the New York Times published this thing with the name identified, I don't think that anybody would say that, aha, what this does is trigger the 25th Amendment. What they would say is, now that we know who it is, we can figure out why it is that this person resigned, and you can start to engage a counterattack against that party. And of course, you cannot counterattack against an anonymous person, which means that the charges are more effective, even though it also turns out, I think, that they're less principled.
Not that its application would necessarily be limited to this, but is it fair to say that this part of the 25th Amendment was really drafted it with the scenario in mind, like what happened to Woodrow Wilson in his second term, where you have a president who is physically felled and arguably incapable of doing the job on a physical level, but we've never really had an occasion where it comes down to the sort of the president's judgment and temperament.
Yes, I agree. I mean, this was during the last years of the Wilson administration. It was the second wife who probably ran everything. There were some very serious lapses in judgment during that period. The whole problem about the League of Nations, about Versailles, everything that went on, the FBI investigations, the Palmer raids and so forth, all happened when Wilson was essentially comatose or near to it. And you surely want to have a replacement, and you don't want it to be the spouse. You want it to be somebody else. But so long as the president is there to protest his innocence and his sanity, it seems to me that it's very difficult to invoke the 25th Amendment. And I think if you want to do it, you have to be a stand-up guy and say, look, I work with this president in the White House. He has chapter and verse of the things that he's done. I've resigned from this administration. I'm willing to take the heat from it so that you could cross-examine him. The danger about anonymity when you're making charges is there's no cross-examination. And you mentioned the Federalist Papers at the beginning. Nobody wants to cross-examine the author of those papers for motivation. What you do is you look at the arguments. You say, do we really think the extended republic is or is not a better way in which to tame the factions? And you could argue the point on the merits. This kind of stuff, you have to know who is making the charge in order for it to be viable. And I think it would be a huge political victory for the New York Times and its supporters to try to trigger an investigation of this sort off some kind of an anonymous piece.
Final thing I'll ask you, Richard. You have said on previous installments of the show that you think that, A, the president should resign, not because of any one thing necessarily, but because you don't think he's up to the job. And B, that you do not think that there are sufficient grounds at this point for impeachment. So the space between those two views is interesting because you're telling us that this is a man who's not up to doing this job, but also that there is no mechanism that could be properly invoked to remove him from it. So from that position, did the founders, who had very robust debates about the nature of the executive, do enough, in your judgment, to safeguard it from abuse?
Look, I think they did the best that they did. Let me start back from the beginning to see how you got into this particular mess. What happened is, quite consciously, the United States opted for a presidential instead of a parliamentary decision. And this means, in effect, that the president is not accountable to the Senate or to the House because he's not selected amongst their ranks as they were in England, where it was either a lord or a commoner who became prime minister. So in England, if you want to get rid of somebody, the House that appointed this fellow can undo it with a vote of confidence. And confidence is exactly the kind of thing that I was talking about when I said I wish that the president would resign because of his bad judgment. But we do not have that kind of a system. And so you cannot essentially undo a popular election where the president has independent authority by simply having the Congress say, we just don't like this fellow anymore. So what is it that you're going to have to do in order to undo this? What you have to do is you have to make sure that he cannot be removed by a vote of confidence of the two houses, which are independent of him, and he's independent of them. That's why whatever we mean mean by the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors. We mean something more than a lack of confidence. Well, this means, in effect, that there necessarily has to be a kind of a space in which somebody like Trump can fit, where you can't do anything about it except to implore him, please resign, which you know is not going to happen. And indeed, I'm reluctant to push that particular issue now because I don't want to be seen as in league with a group of Democrats who want to get him for very different reasons on very different grounds. And the basic reason why you do this is if you make impeachment too easy, the presidential system falls down. So you have to be prepared to tolerate some cases in which it turns out that the president behaves in a very unsatisfactory fashion, just on matters of decorum, style, and taste, and there's nobody who could do anything about it. The remedy you have is a four-year term and an election and so forth. Trump will also pay, I think, a very high price because there's a very good chance that his shenanigans in the eyes of most to the public will lead to a resurgence of Democrats in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And if it turns out that he loses the two of those things, Lord knows what would happen. It's very clear that there's some people on the Democratic side who believe that the Michael Cohen incident, this kind of report, the Helsinki Accord arrangements that were had and so forth, all justify either alone or together some kind of impeachment. And of course, there's always the Russian investigation hanging over the head of the president and this sort. And I think that's also an effort to try to get him on something where when I look at these particular allegations, I don't see anything whatsoever that establishes a connection between Trump and the Russians. But the president always puts the foot in his mouth. And in order to deny the charges of collusion, he takes the very preposterous position that the Russians never try to meddle in American elections when they've done it since the beginning of the Soviet Union. They're always willing to do something of that sort. So he then states these kinds of things. And what happens is now the attention is turned away from the Democrats, where in fact the more credible charges of some degree of criminal conduct, I don't know how much, relates to the entire situation associated with the FISA warrant, where the general point of view is that that warrant could never have been issued unless they used the materials that were gathered by the fusion operation and Christopher Steele, and the very annoying feature that Nellie Orr, the wife of a key official inside the FBI, was working on that particular project when he was a very high official inside the FBI. Those seem to me to be much more credible kinds of charges of some kind of irregularity. And what happens is the Democrats have been extraordinarily successful in making it appear that those things really didn't matter, and that Robert Mueller is to some extent independent as an investigator, even though he's close to Rosenstein and to Jim Comey and so forth. So this is basically a question of rival narratives. And what the anonymous op-ed is trying to do is to make the Trump can do no right narrative very, very powerful in an effort to distract the counterattack mounted by such people as Kim Stassel, and said, look, you have a major conspiracy here that you're simply overlooking. And the more you worry about anonymous editorials, the more likely it is you'll be able to overlook the charges on the other side, which, at least in the current state of play, seem to me to be stronger and more plausible than the charges against the president. I've always said, and I'll end on this note, my phrase about Trump is it's a la carte. One second you defend him, another second you attack him. You never quite know from one minute to the other which side you're going to be on. That's one of the reasons why this is such an infuriating ride, because you can never get into some kind of a comfort zone where you're confident that your judgments, pro or negative with respect to the president, are going to last to the next kind of battled situation that we're going to see. And I'm perfectly confident that this anonymous editorial is not the last of the attacks that we will see by people who are determined to undermine Trump by impeachment, resignation, or in fact, the 25th Amendment.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.